Katra Podcast Conversations for the Curious Essential Knowledge, Simplified, your gateway to essential ideas that matter most. This audio summary has been prepared with the help of a Katra AI.
Welcome back, everyone. Today, we're diving deep into John Locke, you know, the philosopher whose ideas about rights, government by consent, well, they basically laid the groundwork for modern democracy. Mm-hmm. But we're not just reading Locke straight. We're looking at him through the lens of John Donne's really quite revolutionary work.
That's right. Donne's analysis, it's kind of like getting a completely fresh perspective. Our goal here is to figure out why these core ideas, limited government, even the right to revolution, why they came about when they did, and crucially, from the perspective Donne reveals. We often think of Locke as this abstract figure, but Donne says, no, you have to look at the man, his time, his core motivations. And that motivation piece is key, isn't it? Donne argues it's the part we usually get wrong. I mean, Locke's ideas, they're baked into constitutions, especially in the West. But if we ignore the context, that crazy chaos of 17th century England, the religious and political turmoil, Donne says, we're missing the original point, the coherence of it all.
Exactly. We strip them of their, well, their original force.
So this deep dive is about getting back to that original power.
And our guide is John Donne. He's really considered the leading expert on Locke, an eminent British political theorist, emeritus professor at King's College, Cambridge. He spent his career basically excavating the real Locke from under layers and layers of later interpretations.
What I find so interesting about Donne is his method. People call it intellectual archaeology. He's linked to the Cambridge School, which basically says, look, stop treating these thinkers like detached gods sending down timeless truths.
Yeah.
You have to see them as real people grappling with the messy, specific problems of their day. For Locke, that's 17th century England, the Restoration, the Glorious Revolution, all of it.
And using that method gets Donne to his really striking insight. Locke wasn't some kind of early secular liberal, which is how he's often taught. The standard view tends to downplay his religious beliefs, maybe treating the references to God as, you know, just part of the times. Donne completely flips that. He argues Locke was deeply fundamentally religious, a rationalist Calvinist, to be specific.
Wow. Okay. So if Donne's right, that changes everything. You're saying the guy who influenced Jefferson, Madison, the philosophical grandfather of separating church and state, was actually driven by theology.
That's precisely Donne's argument. His main point is that Locke's whole project, his ideas about knowledge, politics, tolerance, it's all one connected system.
Yeah.
And the glue holding it together is his specific rationalist Calvinist understanding of God and what God requires of humanity.
Okay, let's unpack that term Donne uses, applied theology. It sounds academic, but what does it actually mean for us listening?
It means that for Locke, arguing for individual rights or for limiting government power wasn't just about what works best or some abstract principle. It flows directly from what he saw as God's eternal law, the law of nature.
So politics is a moral duty.
In a way, yes. It's about acting to fulfill God's plan for humanity. Donne insists that if you take God out of Locke's equation, his arguments for rights and limited government lose their ultimate anchor. They just become, well, preferences.
And this wasn't just academic theory spinning. Donne really emphasizes how Locke's writing comes directly out of that 17th century chaos civil war, the fear of tyranny, religious fighting. He wasn't just thinking, he was responding to urgent crises.
He was trying to find a stable, rational,
and
for him, godly foundation for government in a world where divine right monarchs were causing chaos and bloodshed. His philosophy was a tool, maybe even a weapon, against that kind of unchecked power.
Let's trace how he built that tool, starting with Locke himself. His early life, you mentioned Puritanism, the English Civil War, that must have left a mark.
Oh, definitely. A deep suspicion of absolute authority, whether it was the church or the state. But the real catalyst was his connection with the Earl of Shaftesbury.
Anthony Ashley Cooper, right? A major political player.
Exactly. Shaftesbury was a leading Whig opposing the king. He pulled Locke right into the heart of dangerous political intrigue. Locke even ended up in exile in Holland for a while. It shows his ideas weren't developed in some ivory tower. They came out of real political struggle and risk.
And that pressure pushed him to build a philosophical base camp, something strong enough to challenge absolutism. Which brings us to his work on knowledge, the essay concerning human understanding. This is where he lays out his epistemology, how we know what we know.
Right, and the famous idea, no, innate ideas. The mind starts as a tabula rasa, a blank slate.
Seems simple, but you're saying it was explosive.
Politically, yes. Think about it. If a king claims his authority is God-given, implanted in every soul from birth, that's an innate idea. Locke saying, nope, blank slate, completely undermines that justification for absolute rule. It also challenges religious leaders claiming special innate knowledge.
So, no shortcuts to truth. No king or bishop has a secret hotline to God that ordinary people don't. Instead, we have to use our reason, which Locke saw as God-given, plus our experience, our senses, empirical investigation, to figure out the moral rules built into the world, the law of nature.
Precisely. Reason's purpose, for Locke, is to discern that law of nature, God's will embedded in creation, it's accessible to everyone through reason and observation.
Okay, so that naturally leads to the political stuff, the two treatises of government. We always hear Locke versus Hobbes. For Dunn's Locke, the key difference is the state of nature, right? It's not Hobbes' war of all against all.
Not at all. Locke's state of nature isn't lawless. It's already governed by the law of nature, by God's commands. Everyone is free, everyone is equal, and everyone is obligated by God not to harm another's life, health, liberty, or possessions.
And rights. Where do they come from in this picture?
This is crucial for Dunn. Rights aren't human inventions or gifts from a government. They are divine endowments. We have them because we are God's creatures, his property, in a sense. That's the foundation.
That completely reframes the social contract, then, if rights exist before government.
Then government's job is simply to protect those pre-existing rights.
Hmm.
People consent to form a government, but that government is only a trustee. It's not the ultimate boss.
Like hiring security guards for the neighborhood.
Kind of, yeah. Its role is strictly limited to protecting what Locke called property, which for him meant life, liberty, and estates, material possessions. If the government breaks that trust, steps outside that limited role,
it loses its legitimacy.
Completely. Which leads directly to Locke's most radical idea, the right of revolution.
The ultimate safety net. If the trustee violates the agreement, starts taking property without justification, ruling arbitrarily,
then it's the government that has broken the law of nature. It's essentially declared war on the people. Resisting that illegitimate power isn't just an option. Locke sees it almost as a duty. It's self-defense, aimed at restoring the order God intended.
But hang on. If Locke's framework is so deeply theological, as Dunn argues, how did later figures, like the American founders, who were arguably more secular or deist, adopt his ideas so readily? They often seem to drop the explicit God talk.
That's a really important question, and it gets to the heart of Dunn's point about modern interpretations. He'd likely argue they adopted the structure of Locke's arguments, the limited government, the idea of rights coming first, because that structure was incredibly effective for limiting power.
Right.
But in stripping away the specific theological foundation, they left a kind of void. It raises the challenge for modern secular thought. If rights aren't grounded in a divine creator, what is their ultimate unshakable justification? Where does that universality come from?
That's a deep question for sure. Okay. Let's pivot to the last big piece of Locke's system, according to Dunn, religious toleration. This comes through in a letter concerning toleration.
Yes, and again, Dunn shows the argument is fundamentally theological, not secular indifference. Locke argues very strongly that the state, the civil magistrate, deals with outward force and civil interests protecting life, liberty, property.
Stuff you can see and regulate.
Exactly. But true religious faith, that requires inward persuasion. It's about genuine belief in the mind and heart. And you simply cannot force belief with laws or punishment. It doesn't work.
So state coercion in religion is pointless.
Worse than pointless.
Yeah.
It's tyrannical because it oversteps the state's legitimate bounds. And it's theologically absurd because forced faith isn't real faith in God's eyes. The state is simply incompetent when it comes to saving souls.
So the argument for separating church and state for Locke isn't about sidelining religion. It's about protecting the authenticity of religious faith from the clumsy, coercive hand of the state.
That's the core of it. Although it's important to remember, as Dunn highlights, Locke wasn't advocating for universal toleration by today's standards. He famously excluded atheists.
Why atheists?
I believe that if you didn't believe in God, you couldn't be trusted to keep oaths or promises, which undermine the whole basis of the social contract. And he also excluded Roman Catholics.
Because?
Because he saw them as owing primary allegiance to a foreign power, the Pope, which made them a political threat in the context of 17th century England. It shows Locke was a practical thinker responding to his time, not just an abstract theorist.
Right, grounded in the realities he faced. Okay, let's pull back and look at the main themes Dunn wants us to take away from this rereading of Locke. The first one seems unavoidable, theology as the foundation.
Absolutely. That's the big one. Dunn forces us to see that for Locke himself, the commitment to individual rights and limited government was ultimately anchored in his belief in a rational God who created a moral order. When we take the theology out, we inherit the political machinery, but maybe lose the original why. It pushes modern secular thinking to ask, okay, what's our bedrock for universal rights?
The second theme Dunn brings out is intellectual humility leading to political caution. Locke's whole epistemology, the blank slate, the limits of human understanding, it directly informs his politics.
Yeah, if we don't have innate perfect knowledge, if everything we know is filtered through fallible experience, then we have to be cautious about claiming absolute truth. That leads directly to arguing for religious toleration and for constitutional limits on anyone's power.
That feels very relevant today. A call for leaders, maybe all of us, to acknowledge we might not have all the answers.
Exactly. If the people, the ultimate source of political authority, are inherently fallible, then the government they create must logically be limited, accountable, and open to being challenged.
And the third big theme, just to hammer it home, is the primacy of natural rights over government.
Rights come first. Government comes second, and only conditionally. It's the servant, created for one purpose, secure those pre-existing rights. That's the fundamental argument against arbitrary government action, whether it's seizing property or restricting basic freedoms. If the government oversteps, it fundamentally breaks the deal.
Dunn really makes Locke's language feel potent again. Maybe we could look at a few key phrases or quotes that capture this through Dunn's interpretation.
Sure. One of the absolute core statements is about the purpose of government. Locke says, "The great and chief end of putting themselves under government is the preservation of their property." And remember, property for him meant lives, liberties, and estates.
So a very specific, limited job description for government, not running every aspect of life.
Definitely not. It's a tool with a narrow function. Then there's the quote on toleration we touched on. "The care of souls cannot belong to the civil magistrate, but true and saving religion consists in the inward persuasion."
That captures the state's incompetence in matters of genuine faith. Force just can't achieve real belief.
Right. And maybe one more, linking labor, rights, and theology. "Every man has a property in his own person. He hath mixed his labor with the natural world, and thereby makes it his property."
Ah, the labor theory of property.
Yes, but grounded, for Locke, not just in economics, but in the idea that by working, by mixing our labor with God's creation, we're fulfilling a kind of divine command to be productive and make the world useful, thereby earning a right to the fruits of that labor.
Okay, so if we take Dunn's Locke, this more complex, theologically grounded figure, and bring him into our world today, what are some practical applications or insights for us?
Well, the most direct line is probably constitutional design and human rights. Locke's ideas aren't just history. They're the living architecture behind things like judicial review, bills of rights mechanisms designed explicitly to limit state power. When international groups advocate for human rights today, they're standing on the Lockean principle of inherent equal rights that governments can't just erase.
Makes sense. What else?
His ideas on educational philosophy are still surprisingly relevant. His "Some Thoughts Concerning Education" argued against just beeding knowledge into kids or rote learning. He pushed for experiential learning, developing critical thinking, preparing children to be active, reasoning citizens. If reason is our God-given tool, education should sharpen it.
So less about memorizing facts, more about learning how to think.
Pretty much. And finally, Dunn's analysis gives us a powerful framework for thinking about church and state issues today. It provides a robust argument for religious freedom that isn't based on indifference, but on the state's fundamental inability to deal with genuine faith. It argues religious freedom protects both the state from overreach and faith from being coerced and falsified.
That's a really useful perspective. Looking back on this whole deep dive through Dunn's work, what do you think is the single most valuable takeaway?
For me, it's the reminder that really powerful, game-changing political ideas often emerge from grappling with real-world problems, with practical, messy challenges like tyranny and civil war, not just abstract thought experiments. It highlights the power of combining, you know, deep thinking with practical wisdom.
Yeah, that's a great point. What stands out most for me, I think, is realizing the complex and surprisingly theological roots of ideas we often treat as purely secular. The language of rights, consent, revolution, knowing it was forged in that intense religious context gives it a different weight, a deeper history.
It definitely adds a layer of seriousness that sometimes gets lost in modern debates, doesn't it?
It really does. See you next time with another remarkable thinker, another powerful book, and another idea that has shaped our world. This audio summary is brought to you by Akatra Foundation.